This recording of the Sunstone Symposium series is brought to you by Signature Books. This is Steph Lauritsen here to discuss our new release, Natural Born Seer, Joseph Smith, American Prophet, 1805 to 1830, by Richard S. Van Wagner. In case anyone is wondering, yes, we do pride ourselves on being able to make up excessively long titles for all of our history books. There is actually a reason for Natural Born Seer's very long and very specific title. This is part of a three-volume biography on the life of Joseph Smith. Each book covers a different part of the prophet's life and is written by a different author. This allows each book to explore Joseph Smith's life in more detail, and it allows readers to see Smith from multiple perspectives. Natural Born Seer covers Joseph's childhood through the early days of the church, up to when he makes the decision to leave for Kirtland, Ohio. The second book will cover Smith's ministry in Ohio and Missouri, and the final book examines the Nauvoo period and the final years of Smith's life before his death in Liberty Jail. Incidentally, we already published the last book in this series because releasing books in chronological order is too traditional for an unorthodox publisher like us. The final book, Glorious in Persecution by Martha Bradley Evans, came out last year and covers Smith's introduction of polygamy to the saints and his wife Emma Smith's reaction. Again, this is one of the benefits of having a different author for each volume. Bradley Evans is one of the few Smith biographers to examine polygamy as a female and through a female lens. It adds a dimension to church history and women's studies that is largely absent in traditional Mormon narratives. But back to Van Wagner and Natural Born Seer. Van Wagner examines Joseph Smith through the lens of both a Mormon and a self-identified rock-ribbed skeptic. His goal was not to reconcile or ignore troubling aspects of Smith's history, but to present them honestly and as objectively as possible. In the book's introduction, Van Wagner acknowledges that Joseph Smith led a life full of contradictions. On the one hand, Smith is presented as a charismatic, spiritually sincere, religious seeker blessed with areas of innate genius. In the book, Van Wagner presents strong evidence that both Joseph Smith and his father, Joseph Sr., had photographic memories and could memorize and repeat large passages of books with ease. On the other hand, Smith often acted with a covertness supported by lies and deliberate half-truths. In a letter to the Senate and House of Representatives, Smith claimed his father fought in the Revolutionary War, even though his father was only four when the war began. His first forays into polygamy were done in secret, and he was often predatory in initiating his relationships with women and future wives. But for Van Wagner, the existence of a complex, multifaceted Joseph Smith is not necessarily a bad thing, or even a sign that Joseph's contact with divinity was false. In Van Wagner's writing, both the Joseph revered by Mormons and the Joseph reviled by his enemies exist simultaneously. Van Wagner successfully presents the argument that both history and Mormonism benefit from understanding Joseph as a complex person. He states, "I do not deny the prevalence or roles of deception and dishonesty in society. I merely ask about their place and function in the lives of people revered as God's messengers. My own perspective is of a creator whose principal attributes are truth and love, and who still expects, despite our repeated failures, honesty and integrity from each of us." He continues, "I am a descendant of some who were with Joseph Smith in the beginning and have been no doubt influenced by, drawn upon, and benefited from the heritage of my believing ancestors. It is in part to honor their commitments to the truth as they believed it that I have not presumed to write a biography in the tradition of apologetic history. First and foremost, I am an investigative biographer, interested in both truth and falsehoods and their ramifications. I believe that truth can only be strengthened by serious-minded investigation." A year before his death, Joseph Smith made an interesting statement to a group of followers and family members. "You don't know me. You never knew my heart. No man knows my history. I cannot tell it. I shall never undertake it. I don't blame anyone for not believing my history. If I had not experienced what I have, I could not have believed it myself." In a sense, Signature Books and its partner, the Smith Pettit Foundation, is trying to do something Joseph himself found impossible, trying to understand the motivations, beliefs, and heart of a man equal parts flawed and inspiring. Natural Born Seer is available on Amazon in both print and Kindle editions, and if you are in Salt Lake, it is available at several local bookstores, including Benchmark Books. Thank you.
you're listening to the Sunstone Podcast by the Sunstone Education Foundation, bringing you quality discussions surrounding Mormonism from the recorded audio from our past summer symposiums. Sunstone brings you over 40 years of engaging, thoughtful discussions around Mormonism. Check us out on iTunes under Sunstone Magazine, visit our website at sunstone.org, and join us for our many conferences and events.
When I was a little girl, and on those wonderful occasions that you weren't very sick, but you got to stay home in bed, there was a serial some of you of my generation may recall called Helen Trent. The announcer daily sought to answer the question, can a woman of 35 and beyond find romance? Well, I felt at that time that an affirmative answer to that question was not credible. I feel a little bit like that today. When we think of the nicely dressed, gentle-spoken, good family man attending piano recitals and back-to-school night, holding a temple recommend, perhaps the elders' quorum president, perhaps the primary chorister, man or woman, I should have said, our neighbor down the street, our brother-in-law, our grandfather, our friend, the answer also becomes very difficult to be credible. But I would like you to keep somewhat that image of that man or woman in your mind as our panelists discuss this pressing issue. How is it possible for kind, nice, genteel, respectable citizens to indulge in one of the most heinous crimes, child sexual abuse, known to man? We appreciate very much our panelists. They will take 15 minutes each, and then we will have a full half hour for questions and discussions. Our first panelist, Dr. Carlos Roby, is Executive Director of the Intermountain Sexual Abuse Treatment Center, which is the largest evaluation and treatment center in the Intermountain West devoted exclusively to child sexual abuse. Dr. Roby has formerly been clinical director of the sex offender program at the Utah State Prison, has been a consultant to LDS Social Services, and has had numerous jobs and been on numerous task forces relating to this subject, and in my opinion probably knows as much about assessment and treatment of offenders, both juvenile and adult, as anyone in our community. Brent D. Ward is currently Senior Vice President and General Counsel for Huntsman Chemical Corporation in Salt Lake. From 1981 until February 1989, he served as the United States Attorney for Utah. While he served in this capacity, Mr. Ward focused the resources of his office on economic crime, drug trafficking, obscenity, drug abuse prevention in the schools, protection of archaeological resources, and he spearheaded laws against criminal fraud, child sexual abuse, and drug trafficking. Mr. Ward currently serves as a member of several statewide task forces and boards dedicated to improve the criminal justice system and protection of children. Our next panelist has very graciously consented to share with us, her personal story of the trauma her family has undergone as one of her children was a victim of sexual abuse, Marcia. Our next final panelist, Laura Blanchard, is currently the program chairperson of the Utah County Child Abuse Council, and is chairperson of the advisory board for Utah County Children's Justice Center. She has long been an advocate of children and knows a great deal about how the church interfaces with the legal and treatment agencies in dealing with this problem. So we will have 15-minute presentations. If the panelists go over, I will tug on their coats or jackets.
I'm C.Y. Roby. As Marion mentioned, I'm currently the Executive Director of Intermountain Sexual Abuse Treatment Center. It's a pleasure for me to be here. Hopefully what we have to say to you will somehow impact you, that you'll get involved in your various communities and try to help curb the rising tide of sexual abuse. A lot of people think because we live in Utah, because we live in an Intermountain area, because we live in a highly conservative area, we probably don't experience sexual abuse to the same extent as more metropolitan areas. Unfortunately, that is not the case. In fact, the statistics that I have from a few cursory studies, as well as statistics from the Division of Family Services, as well as the Department of Corrections of the state of Utah, suggest that we actually experience slightly higher incidence rates of child sexual abuse than most other states in the nation. In fact, Utah was number 2 per capita in the number of investigated and reported cases of child abuse and neglect just a couple of years ago. I first became involved with Utah State Prison in 1982. The rise in child sexual abuse between 1982 and 1988, according to the Division of Family Services, has been 573%. And those are substantiated cases, not just cases where it's been reported and unsubstantiated. ISAT, Intermountain Sexual Abuse Treatment Center, started out as a very, very small clinic in 1983. Marion Smith, our moderator, was actually the founding executive director of that agency. When I came on to ISAT in 1984, I think we had 4 therapists, and we acted out of 1 small office in Salt Lake City. Intermountain Sexual Abuse Treatment Center now has 8 offices across the state, from Logan all the way down to St. George, and employs some 60 therapists that deal only with child sexual abuse cases. In fact, when we took a look at the statistics only 2 years ago, ISAT provided 4,617 direct client hours. So that's in 1989-1990. In 1991, thus far, we've provided 37,596 direct client hours in terms of treatment to child abuse victims and perpetrators. Prior to the time that I became the executive director of Intermountain Sexual Abuse Treatment Center, I was the clinical director at Utah State Prison. When I first started with Utah State Prison in 1981, Utah State Prison had approximately 7% of their offenders being sexual offenders. That number now approaches 27%. So we're seeing not only a huge problem in terms of the impact that the victims are having on the resources of the state and its ability to adequately treat them, we're also seeing an incredible impact in terms of the number of sexual abuse perpetrators. As Marion mentioned, one of the things that's very, very interesting in this particular area is child sexual abuse perpetrators can come from any background. More so than any other forensic population, they spread throughout and across the socioeconomic status lines. We work with numerous bishops. We work with stake presidents at times that have committed such acts. We also work with lawyers, doctors, dentists, policemen, scout leaders, etc. It's a very, very traumatic problem. The far-reaching effects of sexual abuse go on not just during the period of the abuse, but they go on for years afterwards. In just the last few years, there's been a new clinical syndrome that has been basically approved in the professional arena, what we call AMACS, or Adults Molested as Children. One of the concerns that I currently have is the failure of many individuals to adequately follow the reporting laws of the state of Utah. Any individual, with only one exception that I'll go into, is required to report any suspected abuse or neglect. That doesn't mean that it has to be proven. It's any suspected abuse or neglect. Some of the individuals that I've talked to have been concerned that if, in fact, they did report that and it turned out to be a false report, they could be prosecuted. You need to understand that, actually, there are also statutes that protect you as long as that report was done in good faith. The only exception that we have in this state as far as reporting is what has been commonly referred to as a priest-penitent relationship. If an offender goes and talks to a clergy that is appropriate to receive a confession, and in the confines of that confession divulges the information that he has sexually abused a child, that confession can be protected. What that means is it's only limited to the perpetrator, and it is only limited to that confessional setting. If you are, for example, a church member that does not appropriately receive confession, such as a home teacher, and you receive that information, you are required to report. This is in contrast to things that some church authorities have stated. Another thing that you need to understand is that if any other individual reports that abuse, in other words, if the wife of the perpetrator then comes in after the fact and reports that abuse, the bishop is required to report it. The only person he can protect in that priest-penitent relationship is the actual offender. And there's a great deal of mistakes going on right now in this state that has a great deal of concern for me, because we see numerous cases where child abuse has been known as far as a bishop or clergy or member of the ward or a family member for years and years and years, and that abuse has continued. In fact, that's probably the norm rather than the exception. These individuals without appropriate treatment, and even times with appropriate treatment, are going to reoffend. One study that was done in Salem, Oregon, found that when they asked individuals anonymously that were incarcerated for their first time for child sexual offenses to identify the number of separate child sexual offenses they'd been involved in prior to the first time they were incarcerated, and their average age of incarceration was just slightly over 23, they found that there was almost 400 offenses reported. Per individual, per offender. It is extremely important for us to make sure that we do whatever we can to impact those around us, to understand the nature of abuse offenses, and to make sure that they're adequately reported. If I leave you with anything today, it'll be that. Thank you.
It might be interesting for me to give a little background on my involvement with this problem. I came to this issue in a roundabout way back in 1982, I believe it was. A child kidnapping occurred out in Layton, which invoked federal jurisdiction, and as United States Attorney, I became a prosecutor in that case. It occurred to me early on that maybe this was really primarily a state case rather than a federal case. In contacting the county attorney's office, I found that the state law on child sexual abuse and child kidnapping was really woefully deficient. In particular, the penalties did not seem to suit the crimes. When I reported that to the then Attorney General, David Wilkinson, he asked if I would consider making some suggestions for a legislative remedy, which we did, and in the course of the next several months, my office was instrumental in drafting what became known as HB 209, the Child Kidnapping and Sexual Abuse Act of 1983. And that, when it passed unanimously, became probably the toughest law in the country, in terms of the sheer magnitude of sentences. The main sentencing feature of that bill was a mandatory minimum sentencing scheme, which provided that perpetrators of the most serious offenses against children, including rape of a child, for example, would be subject to 5, 10, or 15-year mandatory minimum sentences, depending upon the court's discretion and given the facts. Well, since that time, as Dr. Obi has reported, the prison population of child sex offenders has risen dramatically, perhaps in part due to the greater amount of publicity associated with this problem since the debate took place in connection with that bill, HB 209. Last year, the legislature modified that bill somewhat. As some of you may know, the 1983 Act did provide an exception for incest offenders, which allowed the court to sentence someone who qualified under certain conditions to a lesser term, an intermediate term of imprisonment or even suspension of sentence and probation. That exception has now been broadened so that anybody, whether an incest offender or not, even a stranger to the child, can qualify for probation if the conditions are met. The conditions were also made more restrictive at that time. And in addition, the legislature last year authorized Organization of Children's Justice Centers, which I think now have been established in Salt Lake City and Ogden. My involvement with this issue leads me to suggest three or four issues that might prompt questions and answers from this audience today. One is, it's evident, I think, from the brief history of the law that I've told you, that the law has been slow to recognize the peculiar problem presented by the pedophile. The peculiar pathological sexual orientation of the pedophile produces a repetitive form of conduct violating the sanctity and of children and resulting in the most heinous crimes perhaps known to man. And yet the criminal justice system hasn't fully recognized the significance of that. I remember reading a study once that showed that by the time the pedophile is first apprehended, he, of course, has committed upwards of 60 crimes against children. And I think the law has been slow to recognize that not only is there a problem in apprehending these people, there's a problem in what to do with them once they're caught. Studies that I've read show that there really is no known cure for the most pronounced varieties of sexual deviation that we classify as pedophilia. And in light of that fact, the criminal justice system probably ought to have moved sooner to, if nothing else, remove the offenders from the general population. And as much as I hate to admit it, in this day of enlightenment, we might say, in terms of the criminal justice system, it turns out that, at least in the judgment of the Utah legislature in 1983, that the best thing and maybe the only thing to be done with these people who commit the most serious crimes and who qualify to be classified as pedophiles is to warehouse them outside of the general population, take them off the streets so they can't reoffend against children, and put them in prison for as long as possible, not necessarily with any great hopes of rehabilitation, but only to protect children from these types of offenses. The criminal justice system has perhaps been slow to recognize that there is a sort of a Dracula effect associated with these crimes, which Dr. Roby has also alluded to, which means that the victim is more prone, after being victimized, especially repeatedly, to become a molester himself, or to become a drug addict, or a prostitute, or a suicide victim. And that is a tragic consequence of this type of crime, which indicates the seriousness of it and the need to do something about it. And so it really deserves the utmost attention in the medical science field to find ways of treating these types of offenders. And in the meantime, as long as it's not possible to treat at least some offenders, to provide a severe enough penalty to at least protect the general population as much as possible for as long as possible. Another issue is the that deserves attention is that the lay approach to treating these people or dealing with this problem, even by well-intentioned and we might say competent and qualified members of the clergy, is clear. It's just difficult, if not impossible, for a non-professional to treat this problem, especially when we recognize that even a qualified professional cannot always successfully treat the problem. Certainly the normal repentance process cannot be relied on by itself to cure the behavior of a pedophile, at least not in very many cases, if any. So I think that churches have come to recognize this over time, and in particular I think the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has made taken effective steps to try to deal with this aspect of the problem. Bishops I know now are encouraged to seek advice from professionals within the church social services department. They have numbers to call. They're encouraged, as you may know, to, if not make reporting this crime to the authorities a condition of repentance, at least to strongly encourage those who are seeking to obtain forgiveness for this type of behavior, that the only way they can obtain full repentance and forgiveness is by also submitting themselves to the criminal justice process and to professional assistance. Bishops are told, I think, that if the report of the crime is not covered by the privilege, they too are in a duty, under a duty to report the offense to the authorities. More training is being given to LDS Church, local LDS Church authorities. Publications are available, and I think there's been a rise in the number and the frequency with which this problem is mentioned over the pulpit, for example, in General Conference. I know that President Hinckley has focused on this problem on three or four separate occasions in the past 8 years or so. Another problem that I see associated with this issue is that there is a tremendous amount of difficulty associated with bishops taking sides or clergy taking sides in these cases. I think that it's obviously appropriate for a local bishop to offer moral support to an offender who's been charged with a sex offense crime, but to go much beyond that seems to me to be inappropriate, certainly if the victim is also in the same congregation. But I just think it's helpful advice to members of the clergy not to attempt to intervene in the criminal justice process, especially by giving testimonials in support of an offender who's before the court for sentencing, or to recommend a sentence to the court, or to express an opinion that a sentence of incarceration by the court in a case like this is extreme. That would be a serious mistake. Of course, it tends to minimize the importance and the severity of the offense, number one. It probably injures the feelings of the victims and their families, and it just is an inappropriate aspect of the criminal justice process, I think, for members of the clergy who are not in possession of all the facts and do not realize all of the ramifications of this sexual abuse problem to enter or intervene in the criminal justice process. And there have been cases, as many if not all of us know, where there has been intervention. And for example, even allowing the use of a church facility, church building, to hold a gathering in support of a victim, I think, is a serious mistake, and one which creates all kinds of confusion that is an impediment to effectively dealing with each particular case and the overall problem in general. Then there's a proof problem that I just touch on because some of you may have questions about it. Families don't want to come forward in these cases. Fortunately, as the matter comes out in the open, out of the closet, as time goes on, this is becoming less of a problem. But it's no wonder that families don't trust the system, because the system doesn't work very well, and they become reticent to become participants in the process. There's no doubt that children are further traumatized by participating in the process. A child who's been raped is, in a sense, of course, as we all know, raped again by having to go through the process of testifying in court about the problem. There's delay and hassle associated with the criminal justice process, and that discourages families. Children are difficult witnesses. They may have been threatened by the perpetrator. They may have a family relationship with the perpetrator that the child does not wish to disturb or destroy. Children's testimony can be easily manipulated. It can be tainted. Children, we like to think, never lie, but sometimes they do lie. Sometimes they fantasize, sometimes they don't. This presents tremendous difficulties in the criminal justice system in arriving at an understanding of the facts that is sufficient to allow a jury to make a decision on the guilt or innocence of the perpetrator. And the law is in flux on the solutions to this problem, which creates more confusion. It's not clear, for example, whether the uncorroborated testimony of a child can be sufficient to convict an offender. It's not clear whether a third party, such as a counselor to whom the child has given evidence, can testify in the place of a child who is unwilling or unable to testify. There are issues before the courts on the isolation of the child within the trial setting in order to allow the child to testify more openly and freely, that is, by having the defendant in another room connected by closed-circuit television, or having the offender behind a screen or a one-way mirror. Those issues are being decided right now by the courts around the country. Well, those are some of the problems that I'm aware of associated with this issue that may prompt some of you to ask questions, which I would be happy to try to answer. Thank you.
No matter how many times I speak about what has happened in my family, it's still a very difficult thing for me to talk about. My daughter was very violently sexually abused by her father when she was 2.5. As far as I can tell, it went on for about 3 to 4 months, and I base that on her personality changes, his personality changes, and the time that I left him when it stopped. She had been a very, very happy, bubbly little girl, always been a real good baby. And then all of a sudden, she started having nightmares. She started being scared of everyone. If I would leave the room, she would scream and she would run after me. If anyone came in the house, she would flee to me as fast as she could, whether it was someone that she had known or not, whether it be my sisters or my mother or whatever. She became scared of everyone. She became very, very sullen and very lethargic. She, at one point, I was extremely concerned about her because she would just lay on the couch and she wouldn't move. She wouldn't want to eat. She wouldn't play. She would just lay there. And I took her into the pediatrician and ran some tests on her, and he says, I can't find anything physically wrong with her, but there's definitely something there. He says, if she doesn't snap out of it in a week, I want her back in. During the course of a month and a half, I had her in there 5 different times with bowel movements, running off the bowels that we couldn't stop. We went through 4 medications, a strict diet to try to get her to quit running off the bowels. Her abuse consisted of oral sex and rectal penetration. There was scarring in the rectal area that was found in the physical that the police, that was done for the investigation. I took her and I left before I knew that she had been sexually abused. My marriage basically fell apart in 3 months. It went basically to as bad as a marriage can get, I think. There was a lot of emotional and some physical abuse, and so I just took her and left. I found out later, 6 months later, I found out from a friend of my ex-husband's that he had been in prison for molesting children. And when I found that out, well, at first I didn't believe it, and I went down to the courts and I checked it out myself, and I found it to be true that he had served time for molesting 6 different children. He'd served time at the Utah State Prison before I had ever known him. And it was like a giant puzzle just fell into place, and I started remembering things that I had forgotten. Unfortunately, as a parent, when things happen to your children, you try to find reasons for them happening. You rationalize them away. There was a time when I found blood in her stool, and I was so concerned, I reached into the toilet and took it out and went into the living room and said, David, is that blood? That looks like blood. And he said, Marcia, you always make too much out of things. He says, that's cherries. I gave her cherries today. He had an office in our home, and he watched her while I worked. And that's when the abuse occurred, when I was at work. After I found out, I took her into the ISAT center, and at first I called primaries, and they had a month waiting list before I could get her in for an assessment. So I called ISAT just for Annika, and I begged them. I said, please, you've got to get her in. And in 2 weeks, they had an appointment for me, and she was in. And after she'd been in there for an hour, the therapist pulled me in, and she says, I've got to report this to the police. She said, I feel very strongly that she has been abused by her father, and she said, I've got to turn it over. And I said, fine. And she basically told me what would be happening next. My daughter was 3 years old at this time. And she looked at me and she said, has she ever called David a jerk? And I said, yeah, she has. And she said, what has been your reaction to that? And I said, well, I always told her that he wasn't a jerk, that he was just unhappy, that he loved her. And I had had a very good relationship with my father. And even though we were divorcing, I wanted her to have a good relationship with her father. Unfortunately, I was keeping her silent by telling her that her dad loved her and he was okay, he just wasn't happy. And she said, you need to let her know that her feelings about her dad are okay. And so that day I took her home and fed her lunch. And I looked at her and I said, do you still think David's a jerk? And she said, yep, he's a jerk. And I said, well, I think he's a jerk too. And she threw her arms around my neck and she said, I love you, Mom. And that night she started telling me what happened. It became a nightly ritual. I would turn off the light. I would read her book, turn off the light. And I'd say, okay, honey, go to sleep. She'd say, let's talk about David. And she had separated him. When the abuse occurred, she started calling him David instead of Daddy. She said, let's talk about David. And I said, okay. And she'd give me little bit by little bit by little bit. And the therapist had warned me that they always save the worst for last. She says, children will give you a little and see how you react to it. And if your reaction is okay, they think, well, that wasn't so bad. And they give you a little more and they give you a little more. And she had told me that I needed to be very matter of fact about it. She said, you can't let her see you cry. You have to be as matter of fact as possible with her, because if she sees you crying, she'll think she made you cry by telling. And so there were different times when I would call my sister and I would say, please come and stay with her. I've got to get away. And I would go up in the mountains and I would scream and I would cry. I would throw rocks. And then I would go back home and start dealing with it again. The court system, the investigation took 4 months. There were 2 videotapes done on her that were, I never saw, but I was told they were very good videotapes. And as soon as my ex-husband found out that there was a warrant out for his arrest, he fled the state. He moved down to California, changed his name, falsified his Social Security number, got remarried, got baptized into the church down there under the ruse of being a new convert. The bishop down there had put him in with the Boy Scouts. It took 9 months for the FBI to find him. And that poor little community, small little community, was just rocked when they went down and arrested him and brought him back for trial. We went through a 3-day preliminary hearing, which was extremely grueling, but thank heavens my daughter didn't have to participate in because of the videotapes. For the trial, she was told she would have to testify. She was 4 years old, 4-year-old this time, and she was told she would have to testify and that I couldn't be with her. And the first time she was told that her dad would be in the next room, she was hysterical for 45 minutes. They postponed the trial for another 2 weeks to try to get a hold on my daughter. And they promised her that her therapist could be in there with her. And the day that she was to meet with the judge and the 2 attorneys for her testimony, they went in. And the defense attorney, as my daughter's therapist was walking in the room with her, said, you can't come in. You give her too much of an edge. Your old child. And the prosecuting attorney, unfortunately, didn't fight him on it. He could have, but he didn't. And so my daughter was in a room with 3 men she didn't know at all. Her father was in the next room. And she fell apart. She could not give them the testimony that they wanted. The charges were dropped on the stipulation that he leave the state, never contact Christy or I again. Within 30 days, he had sued me for custody, charged me with maliciously and with intent, brainwashing her to falsely accuse him, And I spent the next year and a half in civil and juvenile court before his parental rights were taken away. Now, this is a man who had a previous record. My daughter, when the FBI got involved, he told me, he says, Marcia, have you ever seen his rap sheet? I said, no. He said, let me read it to you. He said he's got exhibitionism, he's got lewd contact, he's got 3 counts of being arrested on child abuse, 1 that he was convicted on. The others he got away with. And my daughter was the third time he'd been arrested. Yes, he was classified, has been classified as a pedophile. And unfortunately, I believe he's still here in the Salt Lake Valley. As far as I knew last, he was still living here. But where the church was concerned, I was one of the extremely lucky ones. I've talked with an awful lot of mothers who were not so lucky. But my bishop supported me just completely. I went to him with my suspicions. I was separated at the time. I said, Bishop, I think that she's been molested. What am I going to do? I need to get her in for an assessment. I don't have the money. He says, you take her in. Don't worry about it. We'll take care of everything. And he did. He took care of everything. And so therefore, I was very lucky. There was one point before my husband fled, when he found out he was being investigated before the warrant was signed, he went to the general authority who had married us. And he just sat at his desk and cried and said, as God is my witness, I didn't touch her. Marcia's making it all up. And this gentleman believed him. For a month and a half, he believed that David was fully innocent. He called me into his office, and I told him what had happened, and I just said, I'm not bringing the charges against him. The state is. And I just said, I realize that you don't have access to the evidence. I said, you don't live with my daughter. I said, her nightmares put me right there. And her nightmares are extremely hard to deal with still to this day because they put you right there. And I just said, I have seen David cry and lie to me at the same time. I said, he's extremely good at what he does. He's extremely good at covering his tracks. And he's an extremely good manipulator. And after a month and a half, something happened, and this general authority did believe me. But I want you to know that I hold absolutely no ill will whatsoever towards him, because I knew he didn't know what was going on. He didn't know the man. He didn't have access to my daughter. He didn't have access to the evidence. All he saw was a man sobbing and pleading with him that he didn't do it. And that can be an extremely effective tool for these men to use. One thing that her therapist told me that I felt was extremely important, and I still to this day, is she said, I asked her, I said, is it always going to affect her? And she says, it's like the face of a clock. She says it's 12 o'clock right now, and she's dealing with it. She's doing really well. Come 2 o'clock, she'll forget it ever happened. Come 4 o'clock, something will happen to bring the memories back, and she'll have to deal with it again. Come 6 o'clock, you know, memories will be put away again. She said her first sexual encounter will be extremely difficult for her. The memories will come back. She'll have to deal with it. And it's basically, these kids are sentenced to a lifetime. They have a lifetime sentence. And most of these men walk away with nothing. My ex-husband served 2 weeks in jail for what he did to my daughter. And 4 years after the fact, 5 years after the fact, she still has problems periodically. There are certain times of year that really set her off, when her nightmares will come back. Her baptism was extremely difficult. She, about 3 months before her nightmares started coming back, the worst she's been in 2.5 years, in a lot of issues, some terrible, terrible dreams. And 3 nights in a row, she said that she would wake up and her dad would be sitting by her bed just watching her. And just all of these feelings coming back to her. But through therapy and through being open and being able to talk about it, she's dealing with it extremely well. On the court situation, there were 2 times in the last 2 years where she came to me and she said, Mom, why didn't the police okay, why didn't the police put David in jail? And I said, well, honey, I said, sometimes, I said, you know what he did, and I know what he did, but sometimes it's hard for people to believe. And she said, but he's hurting other kids. And I said, he might be. And she said, I want to go back and talk. I want to go talk to the judge again. So I sat her down, and I said, this is what will happen. And I took her through the whole process of what would happen, and I said, it's your decision. I said, I will support you if you want to go. I will support you if you don't. I said, it's totally up to you. And both times she thought about it, she said, I don't want to do it. I said, that's fine. And it's just, with me, it was a relief simply because I didn't want to sacrifice my daughter twice in a system that at this point doesn't work very well.
Dr. Roby, Mr. Ward, and Marcia have eloquently addressed the reality of child abuse in our community and its far-reaching impact and its frustrations, both legally and socially and emotionally. I am faced with a task which is overwhelming to me. I feel very inadequate to this particular task because I obviously cannot speak for the church, and yet the church is a part of my life. So please know at the outset that this comes with a huge disclaimer because I recognize my own inadequacies. Perhaps Satan has no stronger tools with which to attack the souls of man than those of child abuse and neglect. The underlying damage to victims' perceptions of self and the relationship to God is so pervasive that the long... The long-term effects are so pervasive that they result in a variety of self-destructive behaviors. This behavior, such as substance abuse, academic and vocational failure, aggression, eating disorders, depression, promiscuity, and family dysfunction, frequently cause a further erosion of self-worth and isolation from family, church, and society. It is a religious issue. We do live in a unique environment where the majority of individuals within the community belong to one predominant religion. It may be easy then to use this fact and justify and use it as justification for whatever we personally choose to believe about the problem of child abuse within this state. If we choose to ignore the problem, then we can assume that the child abuse just doesn't happen in a religious community which openly values children and families. Or that if it does, it's just a problem for those who aren't active or may have some other differences from us. At the other extreme, we could blame the church for the controlling, self-serving behaviors which may be exhibited by individual perpetrators. Obviously, neither attitude would provide us with a real understanding of the problem, and more importantly, such attitudes become justification for our own inaction. Our own unwillingness to really learn about and address the problem of child abuse and to serve others as members of the church and the community. At the same time that we recognize that the actual causes and the ultimate solutions to this problem are matters of individual responsibility, we also state the obvious. Our religious beliefs strongly influence our individual choices. The influence of the church, that the church plays is a very strong role in how we perceive the problem and how we respond to the problem. When one religion guides nearly three-fourths of the population of this state, this organization also has a tremendous potential to influence the community response to the problem, both positively and negatively. Child sexual abuse has only been a topic of community concern for the last 20 years. In fact, Plato, Aristotle, and Seneca, the revered philosophers of centuries ago, maintained that killing of defective children was a wise custom. Early colonial America was founded on strict religious principles, which justified physical punishment and even death for the unruly child. The child was the subject of total authority of the parent, and this authority was used to abuse sexually as well, with little, if any, condemnation from society. Was perceived as injured the child had no recognition at all. A primarily Christian society has only recently tried to protect what is most valuable and dear to us, our innocent children. Historically, some religious beliefs may have been misunderstood or misapplied to justify abusive behavior by individuals. While there have been parents throughout history who have been exemplary in their caring for their own children with love, we are still struggling to extend that love and concern to all children by addressing the issue of child sexual abuse as a church and as a community. I believe that we do have the potential as a community to be the best protected in the way we treat our children in the nation. But we are going to have to earn it. We can't just simply want it to appear that way. In recent years, the LDS Church has made an effort to address the problem of child sexual abuse in a number of different ways, many of which have already been mentioned. President Benson directly in an address that he made to the children of the church spoke about this briefly in asking children to reach out, to recognize their need for help, and to ask for appropriate help in these circumstances. President Gordon B. Hinckley also made a very strong statement in April of 1985 regarding the existence of child abuse within the church setting and the general approval of the church in trying to reach out and do something about this problem and not ignoring it. Educational pamphlets for leaders and parents have been prepared. Some excellent resources are available, but absolutely very few people seem to know about them. These being two of them. One is for leaders and this one is for parents, entitled Preventing and Responding to Child Abuse. During the past few months, a new training presentation for priesthood leaders has been distributed. Some of this training is still occurring at the stake and ward levels. It is a great step in the right direction because education of members is truly the key to accomplishing something about this problem. Yet much more information is needed. The training can open the door to understanding the problem of child sexual abuse, but we need to be willing to learn more, to reach out and do more. This additional information is needed in order to respectfully, whether we're members or church leaders. We need sometimes to recognize that there are resources out there, that we can reach out and use these resources. Sometimes, sadly, we close ourselves off from receiving those things that are available within the community, which could expand our ability to serve victims. Church leadership has also supported the involvement of some church leaders and representatives from LDS Social Services and the Church Legal Department in the statewide task force on child sexual abuse. Tremendous good has been accomplished by this group, and it is an ongoing group. This one group has, together with the help of the legislature, established children's justice centers in the state, beginning as a pilot program, which hopefully will be expanded to all areas of the state. This is an outstanding example of a very important point. Much can be accomplished by church involvement through its members in community efforts. Sometimes we have the misperception that these problems are social or legal and that we want to avoid becoming involved in these areas as a church. It is important to remember that in a democracy, we are also the citizens. We also have not only the opportunity then, but the responsibility to effect change where needed and to support the social systems where needed. We are the people. Sometimes in the area of child sexual abuse investigation, we may sense a reluctance on the part of church leaders to report the abuse, and because they have felt some problems with the system, we all admit and all are aware that the system is far from perfect. But it doesn't help to isolate. It doesn't help to feel like we can segregate these problems and separate them. If we don't believe that the system is serving the best interest of the community, then we have the opportunity to become involved and change the system. Systems are intended to serve people, not people to serve systems. It doesn't serve anyone to simply try to avoid dealing with the system. I would have been much more comfortable having a church leader talk about these things. I am sure there are many other things that the church is involved in and doing to move forward with this. the leadership is clear. Child abuse does exist. It is a problem in our state. We do need to deal with it. But we are still feeling some problems down on the individual victim level, where we have situations between individuals, between individual victims and church leaders on the local level that are very harmful, that are hurting, and have serious repercussions for victims and families. We would like to move forward in the sense that there are many things that can be done. And here again, I will say these are merely suggestions, that things that we can do as church members, and if you are in a church leadership position, certainly something that we could do in that position as well to help victims. The manner in which a church leader responds to the disclosure of abuse is extremely important. We need to understand how much that victim or how much that person who may be a friend or a relative of the victim has put into that effort to make that disclosure, to really listen to that disclosure, to listen with sensitivity, to have a prior understanding of the issues so that we can listen appropriately, and then to support and reassure those who are in that position of vulnerability. It is extremely helpful, and I can't even begin to tell you how many instances there are where bishops are supportive and do tremendous good in helping victims, young and old, to heal from the abuse. Unfortunately, I seem to have more of the reports of the opposite, but that's because we tend to complain more than we tend to compliment. It is important to recognize that there are specific things that can be done. We do live in a world where child abuse is a reality, not just in the home, but out of the home as well. It is appropriate to teach our children about their right to personal safety and control of the integrity of their own bodies. Programs within the church, as well as in the schools, can supplement parental training in this area. Listening to our children, understanding the nature of child abuse, and having the courage to respond appropriately to any child's cry for help, not just our own, are the critical requirements for protecting our children. Unfortunately, we are still hearing of some of the horror stories, and I, with reluctance, would like to share a couple of the concerns with you as an educational tool, and I emphasize that these are individuals and their individual human response to a problem. This is not the direction or policy of the church. But we can learn from it about the needs from victims. We can learn what would better serve victims by looking at some of the errors that have been made. And unfortunately, these are ongoing. These are very recent cases that I have heard in the last month. We are still hearing when young victims try to reveal abuse. You must have misunderstood. There are two sides to every story. What did you do that caused that? Why did he do that to you? Obviously, an educational lack. Something is missing that we need to provide. Other types of situations may simply ignore the victim. Perhaps it was someone else that actually made the report to the bishop, whether it was the perpetrator or some other member of the family, a neighbor. But the victim, while the abuse is known about, the victim is young, the victim is simply ignored. It's very uncomfortable for people to reach out to victims until they understand how much that is needed. And the feelings that can accompany that caring then can enable you to do that. But I received a phone call just a week ago from a lady who very much wanted me to tell her. She had just had a young girl in her ward. An 11-year-old girl had been raped. And she very much wanted to hear that the best thing to do about it was to ignore it, that if you simply didn't say anything, then the girl would feel better, that no one would be looking at her or saying anything, and that that was the kindest thing you could do. And I had to quickly reassure her that, no, you know, she was very right in calling. She obviously cared enough to at least call and ask. But there were some things that she could do, one of which was to not ignore it, to directly go to the mother of that victim who was suffering tremendously, feeling guilt that she shouldn't have felt, to directly go to that young victim and say, yes, I know it hurts to just care. You know, you can't necessarily feel like you can fix it, but you can't turn off the caring. Because when we ignore the problem, when we ignore that child's pleas for help, we have devalued that child. And that is what they will remember for the rest of their lives. Another frequent complaint is that the perpetrator is instantly forgiven. And there are a number of reasons why this may occur, or at least the perception of it may occur. One instance that comes to mind is a situation where it was revealed on, I believe, a Friday night to a bishop that a 17-year-old had perpetrated five young girls, 3 to 4-year-old girls, within that ward area. And that following Sunday, that perpetrator was passing the sacrament to those very same girls. Another area in which we may see some concern is that bishops sometimes, and other church leaders, and I use bishops very generically here because it's not always just the bishops, it sometimes is a visiting teacher, it sometimes is a home teacher, it is whoever we go to for help when we feel that we need that help, that sometimes we do not take past abuse as seriously as we could do, not realizing the extreme pain that that person has been experiencing and how difficult it is to even bring up the subject and ask for help. A very recent call from a young woman whose father had sexually molested and sodomized her. And following the abuse by the father, a brother who was 15 years older had also sodomized her for a number of years, both before and after serving his mission. After his temple marriage, he attempted to reoffend her again while she was approximately 16 years old. He was unsuccessful in that at that time. Now in her late 20s, she has gone to her bishop for help because of serious depression, eating disorders, and ongoing effects in her life. She was told, "That happened a long time ago. You should have taken care of it by now. This happened so long ago that you should have repented and forgiven him by now. I don't think you need treatment. Just talk with me and get on with your life." Can you begin to imagine the feelings of betrayal, anger, and resentment? The resentment of the control issue here. She came for help and she received a blow. Remember that these leaders are individual people. This is not the church or the policy. But these are individuals who are struggling with human characteristics that would rather deny a problem, would rather minimize a problem, and even when they recognize the problem, would rather have it fixed quickly and over and done with, rather than recognizing that these problems take years to resolve and a tremendous amount of reassurance along the way. But we can learn and help and educate others. We can learn from the examples. We can become involved in our own community efforts to prevent and mitigate the effects of abuse. We can reach out to individuals who are suffering in our own neighborhoods and take their hands and move forward with them. It is important to remember that abuse arises out of one person controlling another, another vulnerable person, in this case a child. It thrives in secrecy. We must work together as a church and a community to make certain that control issues and secrecy within these organizations never deny victims the help that they need.
I want to thank the panel very sincerely from all of us for sharing their expertise, their knowledge, and their emotional selves over this very difficult and complex problem. Would you like to take your chairs over there now so we can have questions? I'd like you to please direct your question to one individual because I'm kind of hoping that unless there's a strong feeling on the part of another panelist that we will have only one response to a question. I don't want that to inhibit you panelists, but I hope that that will allow more time. And I would also like to suggest for just a second a couple of other areas that haven't been touched on yet. You can't touch on a lot, obviously. that you might be thinking of and that might also stimulate your questions. One of these Laura touched on somewhat, which is the problem within the church system of the adult abused as a child who returns years later, has had no recall, suddenly recalls, wishes either help psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, or wishes to use the church system to have the offender excommunicated. When this occurs, the courts, the bishop's court or the bishop himself or whoever, is often in the dilemma of his word against your word. It's a very prevalent and common problem now. Just one second, and then I'll take your questions. One more area. In every culture, there are things contributing to behavior. Big, profound statement. I'm not trying to say that in our culture child abuse is any worse. I'm not trying to compare it to any other culture. The statistics are there. We know we have at least as much. We do have particular things in our culture that make it play out in particular ways. We have areas of trust. We have neighborhoods set up differently. We have a patriarchal authoritarian system. All of these things, how, in what way do they play into this? Another area that has not been mentioned is neighborhood sex rings. They're there. We know they're there. That's another area you might think about. And another, and perhaps the most important, is, and all the panelists have touched on this, is what specifically can the church as an organization do to address this problem even more than they now have? Okay, we'd like to take questions, and I will repeat the question because for the good of the tape. Yes?
Is it just for the financial benefit of the family? What's the thinking on that?
I think I'll let Mr. Ward address the question. Is what is the reasoning behind an incest offender being given legal probation?
When this bill was proposed, it did not have an incest exception, and I opposed an incest exception. But the legislature was persuaded by the treatment professionals that there's a greater chance of success in dealing with and rehabilitating an offender in an incest situation than there is outside the home. And I think that may have been the... I'm not saying I disagree with you. I'm just saying that's the reason, I think, on which the legislature primarily relied when it adopted that exception.
Yes.
We have yet to hear any specifics about what we should look for as parents, friends, neighbors, primary teachers, daycare providers, whatever. What kinds of signs should we look for in children? What are the stress indicators or what are the clues here that we should look for?
$64 question to Dr. Roby. The question is, what symptoms should we look for in trying to assess the possibility of sexual abuse?
The physical ones are obvious.
Yes, we understand.
Actually, in reality, the physical ones aren't obvious. Even when there's been intercourse in the vast majority of cases, even when there's a pelvic exam done, there is an evidence of penetration. Essentially, let me give you just very briefly kind of the negative facts. If you're a parent, you're not likely to be the first person to find out that your child has been abused. That's for several reasons. One is, even though you may have a very good relationship with your child, parents are normally the ones that not only give out the love and the hugs and the kisses, they're also the ones that do the disciplining. Most perpetrators are extremely good at getting the victims to feel that in one way or another they were responsible for the offense. Because the child feels that level of responsibility, they don't want to go and talk about they were the ones that chopped down the cherry tree. So it's not likely, in our experience, the vast majority of cases that we deal with come out in the context of one child telling another child and that other child telling a parent or that child telling some other individual that's in a position of authority. The greatest benefit you can probably have to your kids to help them keep from being abused is to spend time telling them that it's okay to talk to other individuals about those kinds of concerns because they're more likely to go to someone else other than a parent. As far as the signs that a child has been sexually abused, the signs can be very varied. The lecture that I do on prevention and signs to look for is somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 hours long. If you're seeing any extreme change in behavior, you need to realize that there's usually a reason for that. One of the sad facts is that kids only have a certain number of ways to tell you when they're experiencing trauma. If you're an infant and you're hungry, you cry. If you're an infant and you get stuck with a pin, you cry. If you're an infant and you lose something that is very important to you, for example, your mother moves away from your sight, you cry. As you get older, you come up with more ways to describe and express when you're feeling trauma. But unfortunately, the same signs that we see that can be experienced, that can be expressed in a variety of ways by adults are only expressed in a few ways by kids. If there's one thing I do want to emphasize, it's that there's two rules to whether or not your child has been abused. One is listen to your child. Number two is listen to your child. Usually the problem that we have is with adults trying to basically deny that what the kids are telling them is actually factual.
Thank you. Yes. You can probably answer that question as well as any of the panel. Would you like to respond?
Part of that question I wanted to ask, no one has actually defined sexual abuse.
I'll ask Dr. Roby to respond to this question. First, a quick definition of sexual abuse. The second part of the question, how can anyone look for pre-verbal symptoms at stages when a child is still pre-verbal?
Okay, fortunately I had some notes here. National Center for Child Abuse and Neglect defines the child sexual abuse as contact interaction between a child and an adult when the child is being used for sexual stimulation of the perpetrator or another person. Sexual abuse may also be committed by a person under the age of 18 when that person is either significantly older than the victim or when the perpetrator is in a position of power or control over another child. It's very difficult to pick up signs that a child is being abused when they're very young. There are some physical signs you can sometimes see. One of the most often frequently noted signs is just signs of regression. If the child starts acting at an age younger than they were before, usually they're trying to tell you that something's going on and they would like to move back into a period that's safe. So if you see signs of regression oftentimes, and then there are other unexpected physical changes, maybe symptoms of abuse. But at the same point in time, I don't want there to be a lot of witch hunts. Because, again, kids only have a few ways of expressing that kind of trauma. Another thing that's very important that we haven't touched on at all that I do want to mention along with that is we have an extremely large problem with adolescent offenders committing abuse. The vast majority of adult offenders that I work with started abusing when they were adolescents. So you need to be very careful. You need to be very cognizant of the fact that if you become aware of an adolescent who is acting sexually inappropriate, it needs to be dealt with there rather than wait until we have to deal with it in the adult criminal justice system. Another thing that we've never mentioned is women that abuse. We have some real strong stereotypes. Just quickly, something humorous to point that out. If I stand in front of my neighbor's picture window with all my clothes off when my neighbor lady is jogging by and she calls the cops, I'm going to be arrested for exhibitionism. If she's standing in her picture window with all of her clothes off when I go jogging by and I call the police, I'll probably be arrested again for being a peeping Tom. We have a tendency to deny that women get involved in the abuse, but in the adolescent offenders that we deal with, and we have close to 100 in our program, the vast majority of them tell us that they first engaged in inappropriate age contact with their female babysitter. So be aware that it's there. We just have a tendency to deny it. So we don't deal with nearly as many women as we do men.
Thank you. Yes.
Brett Ward touched on this. Is there really any evidence that offenders are truly rehabilitated?
I'm going to ask Dr. Roby to reply to that again. And the reason is because he has had such vast treatment experience with offenders. The question is, can offenders be rehabilitated?
Okay, let me address that in a couple of ways. I've dealt with approximately 5,000 offenders. When I first started working in this field, the recidivism rates were considered to be around 40% or higher. In other words, 40% of those that were in some kind of a treatment would end up repeating their offenses. Right now, our recidivism data from Intermountain Sexual Abuse Treatment Center, tracking every case from 1983 till the present time, suggests that about 5% are reoffending. Now, there's something that's important to understand. If you ask me, can sexual offenders be cured, I'd say no. If you ask me, can some of them learn not to repeat their offenses, I would have to say yes, most definitely. There's more hope probably for this problem than many of the other problems that we deal with in the forensic population. In terms of cure, it's very easy to understand why an individual can't be cured. Number one, you can't cure someone typically of something that's pleasurable. I've been dieting for the last week, but I still enjoy eating food. Sex offenders, once they learn to take out their sexual wants and desires in an inappropriate fashion, that particular object does not somehow lose the pleasurable aspect simply because they find out there may be some negative consequences that go along with it, such as incarceration. So what we stress is we don't cure sexual offenders. We may be able to teach them, if they're adequately motivated, to avoid reoffending. I also believe that offenders should be accountable for their behavior. And I believe that follows along with gospel principles that mercy cannot rob justice. So I would argue that all offenders need some incarceration. And that's different than a lot of treatment providers. But yes, they can learn not to reoffend.
Dr. Obias, can I just ask you a follow-up question? Is the recidivism rate higher with respect to the most severe types of conduct, the most confirmed pedophile, you might say?
Yes, it is. If we have what actually we're referring to as an exclusive pedophile, one who seems to have his entire adult life had age-inappropriate sexual behavior, it's very, very difficult to treat those individuals. If you have someone that commits violent sexual acts, it's very, very difficult to treat those individuals. If you have someone that has a homosexual preference for children, their recidivism rates look twice as bad as those that are heterosexual pedophiles. We don't really see a difference between incest and non-incest offenders. We thought there was a difference between incest and non-incest offenders about 10 years ago. Most of the data suggests that it's not so much whether they're committing the offenses within the home or outside of the home. It has to do with the nature of the offenses and whether or not they also have appropriate adult relationships. If you've got someone that's never developed appropriate adult relationships, it's very difficult to teach them because most of those individuals almost have a phobic response towards adult interactions. So it's not just dropping out the inappropriate behavior, it's also building in the appropriate behavior. Those individuals need to be incarcerated for extremely lengthy periods of time.
Blue shirt. The question is, do we have any information that's accurate about the prevalence of so-called sex rings in the Wasatch Front? I'm going to give you an anecdotal answer to that before I ask the panel to respond. A very prominent child psychiatrist I know said at one time he was treating children from a so-called sex ring in Bountiful, in Midvale, in West Valley, and in Utah County. This was simultaneously. One of these sex rings was being investigated by the legal system. Who would like to respond to this?
There's no real prevalent studies that have been done on it, but unfortunately, as soon as when we open that door, it's going to be like everything else that we've seen in sexual abuse. We're going to have more cases than we estimated we would have, and we're going to have more cases that we can reliably deal with. In 1985, the national incidence rates were that 1 in 8 or 10 females would be sexually abused prior to the age of 18. That's now been revised to 1 in 4 will be sexually abused prior to the age of 18, and 1 in 6 males. So what we're finding is we never expected to see what we received. When ISAT began in 1983, based on the 1982 estimates from DFS, we were given a grant to deal with the approximate number of cases in Salt Lake County of incest. They felt that we'd deal with 90 cases in the first year. We dealt with 30 cases in the first 10 days and 465 cases the first year. So I don't want to guess what's going on in terms of sex rings because it's too new a topic. Ask me in 3 or 4 years and we'll start telling you about prevalence data.
What is a sex ring?
Quickly, we're talking about one or more individuals who are involved sexually with one or more children outside the home.
And they know each other. They work together and oftentimes trade partners around. Didn't we just recently have an arrest made, or there's at least a warrant out in Ogden for something that's very similar?
And I'm sure you're all aware they're extremely difficult to prosecute. Yes.
committee has not even brought up.
I'm very. I think that we have your point. I think we respect it. This point is being argued everywhere throughout the United States. It's being argued in the media, and I think it's a very valid question. I think Mr. Ward is trying to respond.
Well, I just wanted to say that fortunately not one word that anybody has said here would suggest that that should happen or that that will happen. But I don't know that there's any indication that more innocent people are convicted of child abuse than in the case of any other type of crime. I hope that's not the case.
We have a great deal of controversy going on in the United States now over how child witnesses can be led, and undoubtedly they can be led. Undoubtedly children lie. However, the best data that I know of suggests that if children are lying, it is almost always in a custody case where one of the spouses has coached the child for their own needs. Would you like to say anything further, Dr. Roby?
No, I think that's true. I mean, when I was out at Utah State Prison, I deal now with a lot of individuals that say that they're innocent and they're being railroaded. Frankly, in all the cases, every single offender I dealt with out at Utah State Prison came forward and said, yes, they were in fact guilty of that offense. So I think that the criminal justice system, if it errs, it errs actually in the direction of leniency, not in terms of punishment. And it's true that at times we probably have individuals that are falsely accused. Once again, in intakes where there isn't a custody dispute going on, that's an extremely rare phenomenon.
I think the question points up again what I've tried to stress, the very difficult complexity of this whole area because you're dealing with children.
Yes. I'd just like to state on that that subject that through personal involvement and through involvement with the community and Network Against Child Abuse, which I am co-chairman of, the majority of the cases, investigations are long and they are lengthy. And the majority of the time, unless the perpetrator comes forth and admits he's guilty, the majority of the time they don't get arrested and convicted.
Dr. Roby would like to add one thing.
There was a study just done last year by the Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, and what they did is they took 100 cases that had been substantiated by Division of Family Services. They started at one block of time. As soon as when they had 100 cases, they cut it off. They took a look and tracked to see what happened with those 100 cases. I know that this is just an estimate. I can't give you the exact figures, but I believe out of those 100 cases, prosecution was declined in 52 out of the 100. Out of those where prosecution went forward, and I believe 48 cases, 47 admitted guilt. One was taken to trial and found guilty as a result of a trial. So what typically happens is the problem, I think, is that oftentimes we don't prosecute because of a lack of evidence. But in the times where we actually go forward with a prosecution, it seems to be that we either have individuals that are admitting guilt or they're found guilty. And very seldom do I end up going in on a trial. Most of the individuals that are sent into my clinic are admitting guilt. We have very few that are saying that they're not guilty.
I think the question asks the question also, what about just normal affection? Can I no longer put my arm around my 15-year-old mutual girl? That's one of the tragedies of the whole area, I agree. But I think, as has been suggested, if false libeling is going on, that may occur, but it will seldom get into the legal system. I know that every one of the panelists considered that seriously. Perhaps several of you would like to respond. Who would like to? Dr. Roby? I call on him because he's living this every minute.
I consult every Tuesday evening with the LDS Social Services Program and essentially do co-therapy in a group setting with Dorothea Murdoch, who is the head of the agency that provides the only actual certified program for LDS Social Services that treats perpetrators. One thing that I found that I'm appalled with is oftentimes I'll ask the individual, why is it that you committed your offense? And the first sessions are always very, very confrontive, usually most of the other offenders being confrontive with the new member. Oftentimes they say, my sexual wants and desires weren't being met in my marriage. And I mention wants and desires rather than needs because it's not a need. I'm not going to die or go blind if I don't get involved sexually. usually what they end up saying is, well, what do you mean? And I'll go as far as to say, you could have ended your relationship with your wife and gotten remarried. You could have realistically even gone out and had an affair, or possibly even gone out and sought out a prostitute. Those were options that were actually open to you. And they'll look at me appalled oftentimes and say, well, that would have been immoral. Oftentimes what happens is we stress certain aspects in our particular culture. I got certain lectures from my bishop and from my priest, quorum advisor, etc., as I was growing up. But things such as don't have contacts with kids that are younger than you were not mentioned. So I think one of the things that our church needs to do, and I think that it needs to be done socially, is we need to inform people, really. And there needs to be more of an emphasis on empathizing with those around you. You can't victimize if you can truly empathize. And the problem is oftentimes we're not emphasizing gentleness in our society. We also have all kinds of TV commercials and that really spend a lot of times really telling you that if you're a male and you're not out there and regularly sexually involved, there is something wrong with you. Has anybody yet seen James Bond not go to bed with a woman during a movie? No. He never gets turned down. So what males are really told is, if you're going to be really a male in our society of some value, you need to be sexually involved. And I think that's one of the reasons why males have a tendency to get more involved in this. When their life starts to go to pot, when their self-esteem starts dropping, they move into this area of sexual abuse for the reason of trying to somehow rush in and grab something that's going to make them feel a little bit better about themselves.
So do Mormons need a longer and more specific list of prohibited conduct?
I don't think it needs to be longer and more prohibitive. I think we need to spend more time stressing values and stressing what is appropriate and gentleness in our society, and that people have the right to say yes or no in regards to what happens to them.
I'd just like to say that I believe a lot of it is your basic ignorance. I was very, very angry that I was raised so naive and not knowing what to look for and what was out in the world and how to protect my own child. I had no idea a man in his right mind ever would be interested in a two-and-a-half-year-old child sexually. It never entered my mind. And that part made me very angry. I think we need to teach our young girls, our young men, just what's out there. Because if you don't know what's out there, how can you protect yourself?
Thank you. I'd like to just add one personal comment for what it's worth. I do think in LDS culture we perhaps foster a very strong denial system, and a very strong system that says we have to look good. Our family looks good, no matter what. I do think that contributes. You had a question?
Of our children.
Thank you. The question is to the panel. Do you feel in some instances individual children are sacrificed in order, particularly if a prominent church individual might be involved, are sacrificed in order to preserve a public relations image for the church? Laura, would you like to respond to that? No? Okay, then.
I know that there are instances where, as she's described, where individuals make decisions that are taken in the context of the church and the image of the church and that are counterproductive both for adults and children. And it's a misperception, it's a misdirection of focus that is extremely harmful to children. I do not think it's church policy to do so, and I do not think that those who are really truly aware of this problem at the highest levels would be involved in trying to directly subvert any kind of investigation. But I also know that there is an extreme concern for privacy in the investigation stage, that until the truth is really known, or until they feel confident that they really know the full story, there is a real reluctance on the part of the legal system, as well as the church and anyone else, and maybe appropriately so, to release any kind of information or to discuss it openly in the effort to protect the privacy not only of the adults involved, but the children involved. So there may be two kind of conflicting issues there that kind of impact this. But there is a tendency, I think, more because of our humanness than because of the church necessarily, to deny, to try to look good, as has been mentioned, to try to appear, whether it's our own family, our own personal lives, or the church, to appear that we are better than we actually are. And yet, you know, rather than finding that a totally negative thing and saying, condemn us, let's work on becoming as good as we can be.
Thank you. The second part of that question was, what specific things can we have and can we do as a church? And because our time is almost up, I'd like to reply to that, because I asked a colleague that just a couple of days ago, thinking about this panel. They had a couple of specific suggestions. One was, in all the lessons about sexuality we give our young people, give them a lesson that says, if you have been a victim of sexual abuse and you spell out what that is, you are not guilty. That be stated in lessons. Another is that the church has potential liability, the Catholic Church, and boy,